Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Dee Hyslop. This is being recorded on July 5th, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Americans shrug off searing heat to celebrate. AG asked to probe collusion on rents. Questions about age, fitness, recall 1984. Confusion hangs over sale of RE Colorado, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Americans Shrug Off Searing Heat to Celebrate, by David Sharp of the Associated Press. The burgers weren't the only things sizzling on the 4th of July. Millions of people were under heat warnings as large numbers of Americans traveled to toast their nation's birth with parades, cookouts, and fiery splashes of colors against the evening sky. Travel records were projected to fall with people jamming airports and crowding highways before the long 4th of July weekend to get to their destinations. Across the West, residents were dealing with stifling heat as the National Weather Service warned of a significant and extremely dangerous heat wave. Fireworks, a staple for the holiday, were expected to reach an all-time high, with an untold number of backyard displays in addition to 16,000 professional shows lighting up the horizon from sea to shining sea. This is how we celebrate. It's the bombs bursting in air. It's the rockets' red glare. That's how people show their pride and patriotism, said Julie Heckman of the American Pyrotechnics Association. All signs pointed to big celebrations. The Transportation Security Administration reported that a record-breaking nearly 3 million people traveled through airports in a single day last week, and that figure is expected to be broken this week. And the AAA projected that 60.6 million people will travel by car during the holiday period. Part of the boost was attributed to easing inflation, although many Americans remain concerned about the economy. On much of the West Coast, residents were advised to take precautions to avoid overheating on the holiday. Temperatures were expected to top 100 degrees across coastal and inland areas of California, with heat spreading into the Pacific Northwest. Some spots in the desert Southwest were expecting temperatures topping 120 degrees. Hot, muggy conditions also permeated the Deep South and Middle Atlantic. The Northern California city of Oroville's annual fireworks were canceled as an estimated 26,000 residents remained displaced by the growing Thompson Fire, while hundreds of firefighters toiled under extreme heat to keep flames from reaching their more homes. In suburban Chicago, Highland Park resumed its annual Independence Day parade on the second anniversary of a mass shooting that took seven lives and wounded dozens at the 2022 event. Residents gathered at a middle school for a remembrance ceremony Thursday before the holiday march, which followed a different route than in the past. July 4th is always going to be a day of mixed emotion, Mayor Nancy Rotering said. We come forth today hoping we as a community can remember and honor the lives lost. The holiday celebrating the Declaration of Independence, which established a new country free from British rule, is traditionally marked by barbecue, cold drinks, and the stars and stripes on flagpoles and on clothing, in addition to parades. But Americans were also celebrating in other ways unique to their communities. Off the rocky coast in down east Maine, some planned to enjoy lobster boat races. Descendants of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were ringing the Liberty Bell 13 times, once for each of the original colonies in Philadelphia. The California communities of Bolinas and Stinson Beach, north of San Francisco, were engaging in their annual tug-of-war contest in which losers end up in the lagoon. In Alaska, the city of Seward got a head start with a fireworks display at midnight as thousands of people gathered on a rocky beach to watch during the brief window where the sky dims in the land of the midnight sun. The shells burst over Resurrection Bay as people watched in silence. "It was absolutely magical," said resident Iris Woolfolk. The July 4th holiday generally unites Americans in their shared love of country, but the 2024 version comes against a backdrop of deep political polarization and a divisive presidential race. AG asked to probe collusion on rents. Owners Under Scrutiny manage thousands of units in Colorado, group says, by Seth Klammen of the Denver Post. Two Colorado nonprofit groups called publicly on Attorney General Phil Weiser this week to root out collusion and price fixing among large landlords amid national and state scrutiny of software that allegedly is used by property owners to increase rental prices artificially. The nonprofits, Law Firm Towards Justice and the housing group Community Economic Defense Project, said Wednesday on the social platform X that companies that manage thousands of apartments in Colorado have been accused of price fixing in lawsuits and investigations elsewhere in the United States. They urged the Colorado Attorney General's office to start an investigation. Their call for Weiser to intervene comes as lawyers and legislators, including in Colorado, have sought to curtail alleged collusion among large property owners and RealPage to set rents. RealPage, headquartered near Dallas, designs software that uses a pricing algorithm to help users set rents based on certain data. Weiser spokesman Lawrence Pacheco declined to comment on the group's requests or say if the Attorney General's office plans to open an investigation. The nonprofit's call follows reports that the U.S. Department of Justice has intensified its own probe of RealPage and property owners, including at least one with extensive operations in Colorado. The U.S. Attorney General in Washington, D.C. has filed a separate lawsuit against RealPage and a group of landlords, several of whom own thousands of properties here. "We live in a moment of unprecedented high rents and displacement," Zach Newman, the executive director of the Community Economic Defense Project, said in an interview. He noted Denver's recent record-setting eviction filings. "Most of the people being evicted in Denver are being evicted because they can't afford to pay. It just seems very frustrating to us that large corporate landlords are using a tool that allows them to coordinate rents and to push prices up even more." A spokeswoman for RealPage did not return an email seeking comment Wednesday, nor did a representative for the Colorado Apartment Association. RealPage previously has denied wrongdoing, and in June it launched a website to push back against what it called factual inaccuracies about its product. RealPage's software collects data such as lease terms, occupancy levels, and rental prices from its clients and generates suggested rents for property owners' units on a daily basis, according to lawsuits filed against the company and the landlords with which it works. One lawsuit, filed in federal court in Denver in late 2022 by a renter, accused the company and its clients of participating in a price-fixing cartel to illegally and artificially inflate rents. That lawsuit has since been folded into larger litigation now based in a federal court in Nashville, Tennessee. Two companies have settled in that larger case, including the Denver-based apartment income REIT, which operates as AIR Communities. The national watchdog group Accountable.us earlier sent two letters to Weiser's office, as well as to attorneys general in other states, urging an investigation into potential price fixing involving large property owners and RealPage. Accountable.us noted in one letter that several of the property owners facing allegations in the Washington, D.C. lawsuit also own thousands of apartment units in Colorado. Newman said his group estimated that the vast majority of large corporate landlords in Colorado used RealPage's software. This year, Colorado lawmakers attempted to ban the use of RealPage's algorithm-based software in setting rents. After the bill passed the State House, a group of moderate Democrats joined with Senate Republicans to neuter the measure by inserting an amendment offered by RealPage's lobbyist. House Democrats rejected the change, and the Senate refused to strip the amendment, sinking the bill. The legislators involved with the bill have said it's likely to return next year. In May, the FBI raided the Atlanta headquarters of one large property owner and developer, Cortland Management, as part of a federal antitrust probe. Cortland operates 14 properties in or near Metro Denver, plus another in Loveland, according to its website. Representative Stephen Woodrow, a Denver Democrat who co-sponsored the algorithm bill this year, echoed the Colorado nonprofit's call for Wiser to investigate. "Particularly when it comes to housing," he said, "we have a duty to take all steps necessary to ensure the markets are not being manipulated in favor of collusion and higher prices." Questions about age, fitness, Recall 1984 by Lori Kelman of the Associated Press. The age question for presidential candidates is more than four decades old. President Ronald Reagan answered it with a pledge to resign if he became impaired, and later with a clever joke that reset his campaign from a stumbling debate performance to a 49-state landslide and a second term. "I will not make age an issue of this campaign," Reagan said to the question he knew was coming in perhaps the most famous mic drop moment in campaign history. "I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience." The audience roared. Even former Democratic Vice President Walter Mondale laughed, and Reagan's reelection was back on track. Today, Democratic President Joe Biden, 81, is struggling for such a redemptive moment after a disastrous debate performance against Republican former President Donald Trump, 78. Those 90 minutes last week set off alarms among Democrats, hoping Biden would keep Trump from returning to the White House, and heightened concern among voters long skeptical of how either elderly man would govern a complex nation of more than 330 million people for four more years. More than two dozen people who have spent time with the president privately described him as often sharp and focused. But he also has moments, particularly later in the evening, when his thoughts seem jumbled and he trails off mid-sentence or seems confused, they said. Sometimes he doesn't grasp the finer points of policy details. He occasionally forgets people's names, stares blankly, and moves slowly around the room, they said. Biden has vowed to stay in the race despite signs of eroding support. "I am running. No one's pushing me out," Biden said on a call Wednesday with staffers from his reelection campaign. "I'm not leaving. I'm in this race to the end, and we're going to win." But the question facing him is far more intimate, according to one expert who covered Reagan's health during his presidency. "The most important debate of the campaign is the one taking place right now in Joe Biden's head between the part of mind telling him he's the chosen one and the more self-aware part," said Rich Yaroslavsky of the University of California. "A nation even more accustomed to dealing with age. At its heart, the question, how old is too old to be president, is about competence, and Americans have never had wider personal experience with the effects of aging than they do today. A surge of retiring baby boomers means that millions more Americans know when they see someone declining. For many, this widespread experience made Biden's halting performance during Thursday's debate a familiar reality check. Trump seemed more vigorous, even though he lied about or misstated a long list of facts. When he challenged Biden to a cognitive test, Trump flubbed the name of the doctor who had administered his. For now, he's ceding the spotlight. "Is this an episode or is this a condition?" Representative Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, California, 84, wondered on MSNBC, reflecting the question dominating Democratic circles this week. "It's legitimate of both candidates." Reagan faced the same questions even before he was elected as the oldest president to that point. In 1980, at 69, he pledged to resign if he sensed serious cognitive decline while in office. "If I were president and had any feeling at all that my capabilities had been reduced before a second term came, I would walk away, he told the New York Times on June 10, 1980. By the same token, I would step down also. That didn't happen. Reagan served two full terms, leaving office in 1989. He announced in 1994 that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. He died in 2004. Neither Trump nor Biden has made a similar pledge, and their campaigns did not respond to requests for comment Wednesday. For Reagan, the age issue faded in his first term as any health issues focused on his recovery from a near-fatal assassination attempt in 1981. He seemed headed for an easy re-election, and debates seemed natural settings for the smooth-talking former Hollywood actor, but his performance in the first showdown with Mondale in the 1984 campaign brought the age issue roaring back. The president, then 73, rambled and hesitated. He seemed to lose his train of thought at one point and appeared tired at others. No one had seen him perform publicly in such a way, recalled Yarlowski, who co-authored a story headlined, "New Question in Race, Is Oldest U.S. President Now Showing His Age?" Important differences between 1984 and 2024. Reagan's age, really his fitness for a second term, was now indelibly part of the 1984 race, a striking parallel to what is happening in 2024 in the aftermath of Biden's shaky debate performance. But there are key differences. Reagan was leading going into the first debate, while Biden and Trump were virtually tied. On stage, Biden was terrible out of the gate, said Yarlowski, the founder of the Online News Association. Then, as now, Yarlowski said, the embattled president's supporters provided vigorous spin. Reagan's operation said he had been tired. There was sniping about the staff over preparing him, Yarlowski said. Biden's team cited fatigue from two overseas trips that had exhausted even younger staffers. It was a bad night, they said. Blame flew at the president's aides. Democrats on Capitol Hill griped that Biden's performance had damaged their chances at the polls. And press critics asserted that reporters had failed to hold the president and his staff to account. By Tuesday, pressure was building on Biden to withdraw from the race. The crisis rippled across the Democratic Party just over 6 weeks before its convention in Chicago. It's not clear that Biden and Trump will debate a second time. Confusion hangs over sale of RE Colorado by Aldo Svaldi of the Denver Post. Real estate agents in Colorado face a sea change in how they will be compensated next month, only to have their boats rocked further by the turbulent sale of the platform where a majority of property listings are posted. It could be a good decision, but the way this all was handled takes away credibility. People want to know where their information is going and who this is owned by, said Brett Weinstein with Guide Real Estate in Glendale. Weinstein has raised a red flag on how the sale of RE Colorado, the state's largest multiple listing service, or MLS, has gone down after the abrupt firing of the group's executive team last week, not to mention a broader lack of detailed information on a platform agents consider vital to their livelihood. RE Colorado is the exchange or marketplace for about 3 out of 4 home and condo listings in the state. It is owned by 2 realtor associations, the Denver Metro Association of Realtors, DMAR, and the South Metro Denver Realtors Association, SMDRA. Multiple listing services starting August 17th can no longer post how much a seller is willing to pay a buyer's agent in commission as part of legal settlements with the National Association of Realtors and leading brokerage firms reached this year and late last year. Buyers now must decide how much they are willing to pay their agents. Realtor groups across the country, fearful of additional antitrust litigation, plan to spin off or sell their multiple listing services, and on that front, the Denver associations were early movers. Last week, the 2 Denver area associations announced they had signed a letter of intent to sell RE Colorado to MAZL LLC, a new company headed by Jay Burks, who is described as an industry veteran. But the announcement came earlier than planned after the leadership team at RE Colorado, which had tried to arrange a buyout of its own at the start of the year, sounded an alarm over a potential sale. We disagree with their approach and are dedicated to keeping RE Colorado a broker-focused business partner and will continue to pursue all options to make certain your MLS remains a locally owned organization that is operated in your and your client's best interest, according to a statement RE Colorado issued last week. RE Colorado executives described the buyer as an out-of-state private equity firm with no real estate experience. A private equity buyer of an MLS would have been an industry first, but the information published in the trade press was incorrect, according to DMAR. On June 28th, DMAR and SMDRA fired almost all of the executive team at RE Colorado, replacing it with current and former leaders from the two groups. The associations said the dismissals were for violating non-disclosure agreements, but to agents outside the process, it looked like retribution. The lack of details raised concerns about self-dealing and whether the interest of agents and their clients would be protected. The lack of a clear operational plan post-settlement from National Association of Realtors, coupled with the poor PR and misinformation from DMAR and SMDRA, leaves us in a precarious position this summer. As realtors, we are left in the dark about our future while those in power make decisions behind closed doors. One thing remains certain, the future is unpredictable for us all, Weinstein said last weekend. Part of the problem DMAR and SMDRA faced last week was that they had a letter of intent but not a signed sales contract, and this week they still were handcuffed by non-disclosure agreements. Weinstein has since moderated his opposition as he and others in the real estate community wait for more details on the deal, including who precisely owns MAZL LLC, their motivation for acquiring RE Colorado, and what they plan to do with it. Just one example of the confusion, some agents linked Jay Burks, whose full name was not initially provided, with Equity Title, a subsidiary of Orange Coast Title Company. Some went further, confusing Equity Title with the Equitable Title Agency, an arm of HomeSmart, a Denver area brokerage firm. As concerning as a takeover by a title agency might have been, having a rival brokerage firm own the local MLS, which is supposed to be a neutral platform where all licensed agents can post a listing, is a lot more disconcerting. And if it isn't complicated enough, MAZL LLC is not to be confused with Mazel or MAZEL LLC, which is owned by Shamus Makovsky, a longtime commercial real estate firm based in Denver. MAZL's address, listed on its filing with the Colorado Secretary of State, is 8480 East Orchard Road, Suite 3000 in Greenwood Village. A Google search shows the address associated with Metro Brokers Elite, but the relationship, if any, hasn't been made clear. Lindsay Hall, a spokeswoman for DMAR, said Burks, whose first name is Joseph, is not associated with Equity Title or HomeSmart. She also said more detailed information will be provided in the coming days as non-disclosure agreements are worked out. To quell concerns, RE Colorado, under its new board, released an update and FAQ around the purchase on Sunday. We have every confidence that working with MAZL will not only enhance RE Colorado's ability to serve you, but will also bring added protections given our current legal environment, RE Colorado said in a statement. The statement said MAZL has expressed a commitment to a broker-centric platform that RE Colorado would continue to operate as an MLS and that data would be protected as in the past. Brokers were also assured that listing fees would remain the same or only increase by minimal amounts in the future. And as for consumers buying and selling homes, they shouldn't see any changes regarding the platform. That said, a lot of other changes will come August 17th. Weinstein said RE Colorado represents the most valuable asset that DMAR and SMDRA own. Smaller buy-side commissions could reduce the number of active agents and HERP membership counts at the associations in the months and years ahead. The two groups, not to mention the National Association of Realtors, will be under increasing financial pressure going forward, so it makes sense to get the best price possible now. His regret is that the region, rather than showing how to do it right, provided an example of what not to do. And there is a scenario where multiple listing services, at least in their current form, eventually could disappear. Weinstein said he hopes that client information, which agents work hard to protect, continues to be protected even under private owners. Matt Laprino, a Denver area realtor with Ramingo LLC, said he isn't concerned about private ownership and sees fresh capital investment bringing much needed improvements, including better technology platforms to replace the outdated and somewhat clunky ones now used. But he also acknowledges that some members of the two associations may reject RE Colorado under new ownership. That's why it was so important to have a transparent and smooth handoff. Larger firms might decide to post their listings on their own websites, or brokerages of all sizes might decide to go directly to national platforms such as Zillow, where consumers already head first. We can be the ones who collect the data and push it out to the syndicated sites, he said. Licensed agents now pay to list a property, the key source of income for RE Colorado. However, alternatives could emerge where brokers are paid to provide listing information, which is highly valuable. The Colorado Association of Realtors, the state association, isn't commenting on the upheaval other than to say it wants what is best for the industry. While CAR doesn't have a specific comment on the RE Colorado situation unfolding this past week, the state association supports all of its local associations as they navigate the changes coming to the MLS, said spokesman Martin Schechter. We are all working hard to do what is best for the short and long-term interests of our collective members and realtors across the state. Students still pushing to make mental health culture better. Now adults, group members in 2019 organized walkout after classmate's death, by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. Students who walked out of Cherry Creek High School 5 years ago to protest what they saw as glossing over a classmate's suicide are still working to share their message that youths can remake the culture around mental health. Jack Patia, 15, died by suicide in March 2019. In response, some of his classmates and his older brother launched a group they called Jack Strong to push for more open discussion of mental health. Four leading members met with the Denver Post on Monday to discuss their ongoing work. The group started meeting to brainstorm shortly after Jack's death, said Gio Villagrana, 20, who now attends Metropolitan State University, Denver. It initially focused on events to draw attention to the problem, including the school walkout and a Colorado Avalanche game dedicated to Jack, he said. Since then, members have graduated and gone to college or started their careers. They also have testified in favor of mental health bills, including, most recently, one that created a mental health screening program for students in 6th through 12th grade. But the core of their work is still focused on helping youths to help each other. Said John Padilla, 25, who is Jack's older brother and now lives in Montana. I think the political landscape and the social landscape were very different in 2019, he said. Rick Padilla, father of John and Jack, said the group has honored Jack's life. He also got involved in mental health, switching careers to work as a suicide prevention administrator for the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment after Jack's death. We all want to be remembered, and these kids have helped keep Jack's memory alive, he said. The most recent data on youth mental health from 2023 showed fewer young people reported possible depression or suicidal thoughts than at any point since 2013. The Healthy Kids Colorado survey found about 11% of youths had considered suicide in the previous year, 9% had made a plan, and 6% had made an attempt. Villagrana said he isn't sure whether youth mental health has improved since Jack died. Young people have even more to worry about now than they did then, but they also feel more open talking about their struggles. Adults also are changing their views. His mother recently talked about whether a family member would benefit from therapy, which is something she never would have considered a few years ago, Viagrana said. That's especially noticeable when it comes to talking about suicide, said Janie Wishmere, 20, who lives in Denver. During the 2019 walkout, students said adults at school hadn't discussed Jack's death or another student's suicide earlier in the semester. The school did hold an assembly that it said focused on suicide prevention, unity, and resilience. I think, quote, suicide isn't as scary a word as it used to be, Wishmere said. Youths need space to process their feelings after a peer dies of suicide, particularly because not everyone grieves on the same timeline, according to Boston Children's Hospital. Adults should be honest that the person died by suicide, but not discuss details such as a method or speculate about a cause, the guidance said. Any memorials shouldn't blame the person for their death, but also shouldn't glorify them to avoid sending a message that dying is a way of getting sympathy or love. High school is difficult for almost everyone, and students need an environment where they feel comfortable talking to someone if they're struggling, said Lily Osborne, 20, who attends the University of Nebraska. They also need encouragement from people who have been through it recently that life gets better after graduation, she said. You just got to make it there, she said. People don't automatically feel better when they get to college, though, because they're dealing with new pressures without their friends and parents there for support, John Padilla said. The group is working to reach more students on college campuses, including through screening documentaries that he has worked on about mental health in Colorado and offering resources to viewers, he said. The top-down approach, where authority figures start a program or tell young people what to do, isn't effective in improving mental health, John Padilla said. Youths need to know how they can help, and one of the powerful things they can do is to ask struggling friends if they have a suicide plan, he said. Research repeatedly has shown that asking about suicide won't plant the idea in someone's head or push them to do it. The only lasting changes come out of communities working together to address their mental health problems, Viagrana said. I don't think that mental health can be dealt with any other way, he said. Probe, sergeant belittled officer over mental health. Mayor lied about comments during internal investigation, by Shelley Bradbury of the Denver Post. A former Denver police sergeant lost his Colorado police officer certification last month after he made disparaging remarks about an officer's mental health, then lied about it during an internal investigation, records show. Former Sergeant Theodore Jim Mayer belittled an officer during a morning roll call in February 2022 on the officer's first day back from leave due to mental health issues, an internal affairs investigation found. The returning officer's name and the specifics of his diagnosis were redacted in records provided to the Denver Post on Tuesday in response to an open records request. Three officers told internal investigators that Mayer said, quote, "Welcome back from the rubber gun squad," close quote, to the returning officer, an informal and derogatory reference to officers who have their guns removed because of mental health concerns, according to the internal affairs report. One of the witnesses told investigators that the returning officer sank in his chair when the sergeant made the comment, as if the life were being drained from him, according to the internal affairs complaint. Mayer denied saying anything of the sort, telling internal affairs investigators who asked if he'd made the comment, "Absolutely not." The police department ultimately found Mayer's denial to be untruthful after the returning officer and two others confirmed Mayer made the comment, according to the report. Mayer, who started with Denver Police in 2004, retired on December 6th, a day after the internal affairs investigation's findings were signed by Chief Ron Thomas. An entry with the state's Peace Officer Standards and Training Board says Mayer resigned in lieu of termination. The Post Board decertified Mayer on June 7th, which means he can no longer work as a police officer anywhere in Colorado. He could not be reached for comment Wednesday. The complaint against the sergeant began when the officer who had been on leave for mental health concerns wrote a memo to his supervisors in which he outlined how the Denver Police Department, quote, failed him regarding his mental health concerns and how he would like to be a part of process improvement, according to the internal affairs report. The officer did not intend to spark an investigation into Mayer, but outlined the sergeant's roll call comments in the memo which led to the investigation. In addition to the rubber gun squad remark, the internal affairs investigation also found that Mayer made continuing derisive comments on a regular basis to the officer about his mental health. In brief, Denver International Airport will close some parking areas for maintenance in July and August. The airport will close parts of the West Garage in phases between July 15th and August 11th, officials said in a news release. The closures in the West Garage are scheduled as July 15 through 21, rows A through D, all levels. July 22 through 27, rows E through H, all levels. July 28 through August 4, rows J through M, all levels. August 5 through 1, rows N through R, all levels. Airport officials warned, however, that those dates and areas could change. For more information, call 303-342-7275, submitted by Shelley Bradbury of the Denver Post. The former music studio and guest house of folk rock musician John Denver is on the market for $8.5 million in Aspen's Starwood neighborhood. Now a five-bedroom, five-bath home situated on 5 acres overlooking Mount Sopris and Independence Pass, Denver's former music studio was built in 1975, 22 years before his death in an aviation accident in California. The Starwood neighborhood, a private gated community just north of Aspen city limits, was the subject of Denver's song Starwood in Aspen, a tribute to the musician's own Rocky Mountain paradise. The home at 580 Johnson Drive is 2,912 square feet with the potential for expansion, according to the Christie's International Real Estate listing. The home's new owners also will have access to Starwood's private tennis courts, cross-country ski trails, horse pastures, meadows, hiking trails, and more, submitted by Katie Langford of the Denver Post. What officials are calling a cybersecurity breach at New Mexico's statewide public defender's office could lead to delays in some court proceedings across the state, the department reported Wednesday. The public defender's office said the breach began June 27. The statewide office, which provides legal representation to low-income people facing criminal charges, is the largest law firm in the state with 13 offices, more than 400 employees, and contracts with about 100 private attorneys. The department said the issue was preventing its employees from accessing some internal records while also delaying communications with clients, attorneys, and the courts, submitted by the Associated Press. Study, Waiting 2 Days Improves Results Accuracy, by Grace Patak of the Daily Camera. In a new study, University of Colorado researchers found that if only one at-home test is available, the most accurate results for COVID-19 start 2 days after the start of symptoms. For the flu and respiratory syncytial virus, however, it's recommended to take a rapid test immediately after symptoms arise. The study utilized a mathematical model to answer questions about at-home rapid test timing and accuracy, not only for COVID-19, but also for emerging tests for RSV, the flu, and other infectious diseases. You cannot use the same test in the same way and expect to get the same results for different pathogens or even different variants, said Casey Middleton, first author of the study and a doctoral student in the CU Department of Computer Science and the IQ Bio program. For COVID-19 testing, the reason it's better to wait a couple days before testing lies in how the rapid tests detect disease and their surprisingly high false negative rate when used too soon. Especially really early on for COVID, when your symptoms first start, we find that if you take that one test right away, there is a 95% chance that a negative result is a false negative, said Middleton. Waiting 2 days after symptoms brings that rate down to 70%. For those who can afford to take a second test on day 3, the false negative rate dips lower, with the tests catching about a third of infections. Rapid tests are built to detect those who are the most infectious, said Daniel Larimore, senior author of the study and a CU professor of computer science at the BioFrontiers Institute. So, if the amount of virus in a patient is relatively low, such as in the beginning stages of an infection, especially in someone who has built up an immunity, the rapid test may produce a false negative. It's not that we were using tests incorrectly before. In fact, for the founder strain of SARS-CoV-2, if you felt symptoms, yeah, you should test right away, said Larimore. But the virus has changed, and humans' immune systems have been updated with vaccinations and infections, and so the way that our bodies respond has also changed. We get the signal that we're infected a lot earlier now from symptoms. Middleton clarifies that although the risk of so many false negatives sounds worrying, making the tests sensitive to those who are the most infectious is an efficient way to keep transmission rates low. If you think about who you care most about detecting, those who have the highest viral loads, the most virus inside of them, are really who we would prefer to catch, and rapid tests are still really highly linked to your infectiousness, Middleton said. As the COVID-19 landscape continues to change, so should best practices when it comes to testing. Because of at-home tests' high false negative rate, especially in those with built-up immunity, it's important to continue to test throughout the illness period if there are tests available. U.S. will kill thousands of barred owls. Action being taken to stop extinction of spotted owls by Matthew Brown of the Associated Press. To save the imperiled spotted owl from potential extinction, U.S. wildlife officials are embracing a contentious plan to deploy trained shooters into dense West Coast forests to kill almost a half million barred owls that are crowding out their cousins. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service strategy released Wednesday is meant to prop up declining spotted owl populations in Oregon, Washington, and California. The Associated Press obtained the details in advance. Documents released by the agency show up to about 450,000 barred owls would be shot over 3 decades after the birds from the eastern U.S. encroached into the West Coast territory of two owls, northern spotted owls and California spotted owls. The smaller spotted owls have been unable to compete with the invaders, which have large broods and need less room to survive than spotted owls. Past efforts to save spotted owls focused on protecting the forests where they live, sparking bitter fights over logging, but also helping slow the birds' decline. The proliferation of barred owls in recent years is undermining that earlier work, officials said. Without actively managing barred owls, northern spotted owls will likely go extinct in all or the majority of their range, despite decades of collaborative conservation efforts, said Fish and Wildlife Service Oregon State Supervisor Kesna Lee. The notion of killing one bird species to save another has divided wildlife advocates and conservationists. It's reminiscent of past government efforts to save West Coast salmon by killing sea lions and cormorants that prey on the fish, and to preserve warblers by killing cowbirds that lay eggs in warbler nests. Some advocates grudgingly accepted the barred owl removal strategy. Others said it's reckless diversion from needed forest preservation. The Fish and Wildlife Service is turning from protector of wildlife to persecutor of wildlife, said Wayne Patchell, founder of the advocacy group Animal Wellness Action. He predicted the program would fail because the agency won't be able to keep more barred owls from migrating into areas where others have been killed. The shootings would likely begin next spring, officials said. Barred owls would be lured using megaphones to broadcast recorded owl calls, then shot with shotguns. Carcasses would be buried on site. The birds are being killed by researchers in some spotted owl habitats, with about 4,500 removed since 2009, said Robin Bowne, barred owl strategy leader for the Fish and Wildlife Service. Those targeted included barred owls in California's Sierra Nevada region, where the animals have only recently arrived and officials want to stop populations from taking hold. In other areas where barred owls are more established, officials aim to reduce their numbers but acknowledge shooting owls is unlikely to eliminate them entirely. Supporters include the American Bird Conservancy and other conservation groups. Barred owls don't belong in the West, said American Bird Conservancy Vice President Steve Homer. Killing them is unfortunate, he added, but reducing their numbers could allow them to live alongside spotted owls over the long term. As the old forests are allowed to regrow, hopefully a coexistence is possible, and maybe we don't need to do as much shooting, Homer said. The killings would reduce North American barred owls' numbers by less than 1% annually, officials said. That compares with potential extinction for spotted owls should the problem go unaddressed. Because barred owls are aggressive hunters, removing them also could help other West Coast species that they've been preying on, such as salamanders and crayfish, said Tom Wheeler, director of the Environmental Protection Information Center, a California-based conservation group. Public hunting of barred owls wouldn't be allowed. The Wildlife Service would designate government agencies, landowners, American Indian tribes, or companies to carry out the killings. Shooters would have to provide documentation of training or experience in owl identification and firearm skills. The publishing in the coming days of a final environmental study on the proposal will open a 30-day comment period before a final decision is made. The barred owl plan follows decades of conflict between conservationists and timber companies, which cut down vast areas of older forests where spotted owls reside. Early efforts to save the birds culminated in logging bans in the 1990s that roiled the timber industry and its political supporters in Congress. Yet, spotted owl populations continued declining after barred owls started showing up on the West Coast several decades ago. Across the region, at least half of spotted owls have been lost, with declines of 75% or more in some study areas, said Catherine Fitzgerald, who leads the Wildlife Service's Northern Spotted Owl Recovery Program. Opponents say the mass killing of barred owls would cause severe disruption to forest ecosystems and could lead to other species, including spotted owls, being shot mistakenly. They also have challenged the notion that barred owls don't belong on the West Coast, characterizing their expanding range as a natural ecological phenomenon. Researchers say barred owls moved westward by one of two routes: across the Great Plains, where trees planted by settlers gave them a foothold in new areas, or via Canada's boreal forests, which have become more hospitable as temperatures rise because of climate change. Northern spotted owls are federally protected as a threatened species. Federal officials determined in 2020 that their continued decline merited an upgrade to the more critical designation of endangered. But the Fish and Wildlife Service refused to do so at the time, saying other species took priority. California spotted owls were proposed for federal protections last year. A decision is pending. Under former President Donald Trump, government officials stripped habitat protections for spotted owls at the behest of the timber industry. Those were reinstated under President Joe Biden after the Interior Department said political appointees under Trump relied on faulty science to justify their weakening of protections. A lightning strike caused the larger of two wildfires that has killed at least two people and destroyed or damaged more than 1,400 structures in New Mexico, authorities said Wednesday. The South Fork fire was first reported June 17th on the Mescalero Apache Reservation and forced the evacuation of the village of Ruidoso. The wildfire now is 87% contained after burning more than 27 square miles. Parts of the village have been evacuated again because of recent flash floods. Meanwhile, authorities said the cause of the nearby salt fire remains under investigation. It has burned more than 12 square miles and was 84% contained. The FBI is offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for starting that wildfire, submitted by the Associated Press. The Colorado Court of Appeals on Wednesday overturned a ruling that Teller County Sheriff's deputies are allowed to act as federal immigration officials to detain people in the country illegally. A group of Teller County residents and the American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado first sued Teller County Sheriff Jason Mikesell in 2019 over the agency's agreement with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which trains and allows deputies to enforce federal immigration laws. District Judge Scott Sells ruled in the sheriff's favor in February 2023, finding the agreement did not violate state law. But the appeals court rejected Sells' ruling that deputies were subject to federal law only when acting as immigration officers and found that Congress did not intend to overrule state laws with the ICE agreements. The case will be sent back to the district court to determine if there should be a permanent injunction, which was sought by the ACLU. Submitted by Katie Langford of the Denver Post. The 67-year-old pilot who died when his plane crashed in Steamboat Springs last month was attempting to make an emergency landing after one of the plane's engines failed, according to a preliminary report from the National Transportation Safety Board. Pilot Dan Dunn and his passenger Jessica Melton, 42, were killed in the June 17 crash when the Cessna 421 spiraled into the ground just short of the Steamboat Springs runway and caught fire. The plane crashed into a mobile home park, and the fire it sparked engulfed two homes and several outbuildings, officials have said. No one on the ground was hurt. Dunn had planned to fly from Longmont to Ogden, Utah, but reported an issue with his engine temperature while flying near Yampa, according to the MTSB's preliminary report. Two children and two adults were killed when an off-road vehicle crashed into a pickup in Morgan County on Wednesday, according to the State Patrol. A 22-year-old man, 22-year-old woman, 2-year-old boy, and 1-year-old were killed in the crash at the intersection of County Road C and County Road 31 about 3:30 p.m. Wednesday, State Trooper Gabriel Moultrier said. They have not been publicly identified, and Moultrier did not know the relationship between the four who were all riding in the Polaris RZR. The 22-year-old man who was driving ran a stop sign at the intersection and crashed into the pickup, a Ram 5500. Everyone in the Polaris died. The driver of the truck was seriously injured and taken to a hospital. The identity of that driver has not been released. Moultrier said alcohol or drug use is suspected in the crash, but did not say which driver investigators believe to have been under the influence. The 1,191-acre Oak Ridge wildfire burning on U.S. Forest Service land in Pueblo County was 25% contained Thursday, fire officials said. Firefighters made significant progress containing the blaze, which was sparked by lightning June 22nd, about 3 miles northwest of Beulah, but were bracing for hot and dry conditions, officials said Thursday. More than 800 people were working to stop the fire spread by building containment lines aimed at protecting property in Beulah and Middle Creek watershed, officials said. Submitted by Shelley Bradbury of the Denver Post. In sports, explosive Cave supplies the fireworks in series finale against Brewers by Patrick Saunders of the Denver Post. Jake Cave has been a spark plug for the Rockies this season, running down fly balls in the outfield, taking extra bases, and pumping up his teammates. Thursday night, Cave provided the fireworks. His solo homer to dead center in the sixth inning lifted Colorado to a 4-3 win over Milwaukee in front of an Independence Day crowd of 48,705 at Coors Field. Cave's first homer of the season came on a 1-0 fastball by Brewers starter Tobias Myers. The dinger, which traveled 430 feet, was Cave's first since August 20th of last season when he played for the Phillies. It snapped a streak of 208 at-bats without a homer. When he got to the dugout, Cave was treated with the silent treatment, a tradition usually reserved for rookies who hit their first career homer. Third baseman Ryan McMahon was the instigator. "That's awesome," said Cave, who entered Thursday with the fourth longest homerless at-bat streak in the majors. "I've done it to guys before, too. I was so pumped up I didn't know what was happening at first as I came down the stairs. Then I realized they were doing the silent treatment. It was cool. It was fun." Manager Bud Black was thrilled for Cave, someone who plays with the kind of passion that Black loves. He's playing a great all-around game over the last couple of months, Black said. He knows how to play. He brings great energy every day in the dugout and in the clubhouse. He's gritty. He's capable of hitting a homer, and I'll go out there and say that there's some more coming. Colorado's right-hander Cal Quantrill battled as he always does. He gave himself a C grade for his outing. I see my job as giving my team a chance to win every fifth day, Quantrill said. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's hard. Tonight it was exceptionally hard. I really didn't have very good stuff. But the way I look at it, if it's a C game and the team gets a win, it's hard not to be excited about that. Quantrill departed after five innings with Colorado holding a 3-2 lead. He gave up five hits, struck out two, and walked four. The four free passes stung him, and he failed to get a quality start for just the third time in his last 12 starts. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Dee Hyslop.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.